You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. We'll find out why justices ruled against the Trump administration's attempt to end the Obama-era plan, what the decision means for so-called Dreamers, and the 2020 presidential race. First, the coronavirus pandemic has upended a lot of people's vacation plans. If you get a flight or a hotel, it can be difficult to stay 6 feet away from everybody. Plus, you never really know how clean those spaces are. That doesn't mean you have to skip this year's getaway entirely. A lot of travelers are turning to recreational vehicles. RV rental companies are reporting big increases in summer bookings. Airstream sales are up 11% over last year. And the RV sharing site RV Share says the number of days booked through its website has more than doubled over this time last year. Elaine Glusak is a freelance travel writer based in Chicago. Her frugal travel column appears in the New York Times. She recently wrote about the popularity of recreational vehicles. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the reasons why travelers worried about COVID-19 exposure may be turning to RVs?
Yeah, there is, of course, the issue of needing to stay away from people. And even if you think you can do that reasonably well, you know, at an airport, you know, or even if you have an empty seat between you, eventually you're going to use that bathroom that you want to share. And there's a lot of evidence that people want their own private bathroom. About half of respondents to a survey by Campgrounds of America said the bathroom was a driving issue. So when you get an RV, you get a house, you get to drive it around, you get to go where you want to go. And you have, you're sort of in control of your own facilities.
During the pandemic, as people travel in their RVs, and we'll talk about how they're getting these RVs in a bit, but do we have a sense of if they're staying close to home, doing cross-country trips? How are they traveling when they do the RV excursion this time?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, it's sort of all over the board. And what the RV rental companies, you know, have told me is that, it's really popular in the West, you know, doing sort of the national park tours or doing coastal California. But then there's a lot of interest in the summer in areas like New England or states like Michigan and Wisconsin. You know, they don't get great mileage. They get like on average 6 to 10 miles per gallon. So the idea of taking it across country could be pretty expensive. So if you're already, you know, if your budget's already pinched by the current economic state, you might want to just take it, you know, down the road, you know, 100 miles, 200 miles, and, you know, set up and have a nice weekend.
I got to say, I've looked at RVs and thought, well, that's pretty expensive. That would be a really big plunge to take. But there are other ways, it turns out, I read in your article, to travel. First of all, the commercial rental market. A lot of people, a lot of companies do this. A lot of people take them up on it.
Oh, yeah. Renting an RV?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Or borrowing an RV.
Let's go rent it first. I want to get into that part I didn't even know existed. Talk about the rental market.
Yeah. Oh, so sorry. So yes, there's the, you can rent, obviously they're very expensive. I mean, these vehicles are massive and they can cost you, you know, $500,000 if you, you know, have that kind of money. So why do that when you can rent one for $160 a night, you know, which is pretty much under the average hotel night in the U.S. And sometimes you can get them for $60 a night and that can sleep two people. So that's a pretty reasonable, you know, overnight cost. You know, the baseline price is not the final price you're going to pay. That's something to keep in mind when you're renting. You know, look at the fees because there's a lot of fees. There's fees for mileage. You want to see what's included in your package. There's fees for things like if you don't empty your gray water tanks, there are extras. You might need bedding, for example, and they might charge you extra for that. So, you know, you can get all this information on their website, but you definitely want to take a look at that and tally it up yourself to see if it's as cheap as it looks at first sight.
We're talking to travel writer Elaine Glusak. She writes the Frugal Travel column in the New York Times, talking about recreational vehicles, RVs, and why they're a popular option as people worry about travel during COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've been into RVs since before they were cool, or you're taking the plunge or considering doing it this year. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And yeah, Elaine, there's this other thing I didn't know was out there. You know, people rent out their vacation homes. You know, it's kind of a sharing economy sort of thing. There's a market for that in RVs. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, totally. It's the Airbnb market for RVs. And there's a couple of big services. One is called RV Share, and the other is called Outdoorsy. And in this case, you know, people who have bought RVs and basically they've been parked in your, you know, in their driveway 50 weeks a year, they'll put them on these platforms and then rent them to you as is. And so you can find sort of RVs that are relatively in your neighborhood, in your city, or perhaps even where you're going if you do want to fly somewhere and then rent a local that way. They pitch it as a little bit cheaper. I'm not entirely sure that it's all that much cheaper, but it's worth looking into. And there's a lot of really cool models. Outdoorsy particularly has a lot of really cool vintage campers that are a lot of fun. And, you know, you are sort of reliant on the owner. Hopefully they'll be able to tell you where to go. You know, they've probably driven it around the neighborhood that you're thinking about or the area that you're thinking about traveling in and can give you strong local advice. You're also relying on them to clean their own RV. So, you know, the difference between renting from Cruise America, which is one of the commercial companies that we talked about, or renting from a sharing service is that, well, you know, the owner's doing the cleaning. So you just want to, you know, make sure they're doing the cleaning up to CDC standards.
Yeah. Is the site that are the services that provide these sort of RV shares, are they talking about that whole hygiene issue during COVID-19?
Oh, totally. Everyone's talking about cleaning and travel. This is the cleanest year ever for travel. And in the case of these RV shares, they're really going the extra length. Like RV Share has a partnership with TaskRabbit, you know, where they'll get professional cleaning services to come in and clean that RV. And Outdoorsy is encouraging its renters to, or its owners to have like 48 hours space between renters. So no one's been in that RV and it's uncontaminated.
And you also, in your piece on this, Elaine, focused some on the smaller option, the camper vans out there. What are we seeing when it comes to those in this time?
Yeah, camper vans are sort of like the nimble and cool RV, if you will. You do give up the bathroom. Most of them don't have bathrooms, but they're just tricked out vans that have a bed. I mean, a lot of times they'll have a kitchen. I rented one a couple years ago in California, and I did Sonoma County with a Juicy RV rental. It's a company out of New Zealand. And it was so clever. It was this Dodge Caravan, so it was super easy to drive. You know, it's just like, you know, driving your minivan. And when you opened up the hatch in the back, it had this really clever little sink in there. You could, you know, hook it up and have water. You know, you can make coffee. And then, you know, the whole inside turned down into a double bed. And then on the very top, there was sort of this pop-up tent that you could sort of, you know, wind up or it would pop up on top of the vehicle. And then you just sort of, as you leave, you just pack it up and it's just like car camping really. And we took it to a campground. You want to go to a campground, you know, you have to park where you'll have facilities with like a bathroom.
We're talking to Elaine Glusak, freelance travel writer based in Chicago. We're talking about the growing popularity of recreational vehicles during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you planning on traveling by RV or camper van this summer? Was this something you considered before COVID, or are you looking at it as an option during the COVID-19 pandemic, thinking this might be a safer, more distanced way to travel? If you're an old hand at this stuff, what advice do you have for the newbies out there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the growing popularity of recreational vehicles during the coronavirus pandemic. They were, you know, already a thing before COVID-19. More people are turning to them after the virus canceled their normal travel plans. Elaine Glusak is with us, freelance travel writer based in Chicago. She writes the Frugal Traveler column in the New York Times. She recently wrote about RVs, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you checking them out maybe for the first time now? Or are you an old RV or camper van pro with some advice to offer for people trying it for the first time? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Anne is with us in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. So my sister had bought camper that she was kind of tricking out. And she said, you know, you should check out YouTube. People live in these vans and they just buy a plain, you know, box van, and they do have bathrooms, absolutely, and they have showers, and they have microwave ovens, and I'm addicted to watching these videos on YouTube of the way that people build these out, and they might spend a little money, they might spend a lot of money, but they're just ingenious. I'm just fascinated, and I'm sure you can rent them.
There's so, Anne, you watch the people in them. Have you tried it yourself?
No, my sister is kind of working in that direction.
Anne, thank you so much for calling in. So Anne's living vicariously, Elaine. But yeah, some people are really into these tricked out camper vans, complete in some cases with bathrooms, Elaine.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. It's a little bit like the tiny home phenomenon on wheels. You know, you got everything you need and nothing you don't. And, you know, it's very cleverly designed. And I should say, while bathrooms are uncommon among vans that you can rent, there is a new company out of Seattle called Cabana that is renting out the four transit vehicles that have been rehabbed. And they have showers inside, like shower and a toilet. So like, it's like a hotel room on wheels. Unfortunately, right now, you can only get it out of Seattle. You can't get it here yet.
And thanks for that call. We'll go now to Russ in Stoughton. Russ, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add a lesser expensive option than buying one of those giant motorhomes or even a van is a pop-up camper, which I invested in about 4 years ago. And there's a lot of them on the market. They're not terribly expensive, new or used. And they have everything except a bathroom, and you kind of tow your house with them. Then you crank up the metal roof, and the ends have the beds on them with the canvas sides. And it has a sink and a two-burner stove and a little mini refrigerator. And it's, you know, you can put four or six people in there sleep-wise that you can convert the kitchen table. So, yeah, it works out well. I bought myself a portable toilet and a little tent that goes outside, so you know, all you need is electric and a water plug in if you can get it, and you're good to go.
Russ, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Elaine, that takes me to another question: the infrastructure. What are the campgrounds and other places that provide Russ's water and electrical along the way? How are they dealing with the pandemic?
Well, it depends, you know, state by state. It depends on the phase of reopening that states are in. You know, some are restricting occupancy, so there are fewer places that you can camp because they're trying to space out. They're trying to space out all these RVs. So I would say that's one strong tip. You need to call ahead and kind of know where you're going to make sure that there's room for you, because if there's more vehicles on the road and campgrounds are, you know, limited in how many spaces they can rent, then you might have a little bit of a crunch. Oh, but I should say there's another movement called boondocking, which we didn't talk about, which is basically, you know, going on public land and taking your RV and basically living off the grid. So no water or electric hookups. A lot of people love doing this, and you can do it for a couple days. Usually, you know, the water tanks will usually hold out for a couple days. And you can, there's a couple of good websites. One's called frugalrvtraveler.com, or you can find these off the grid sites where you can take your vehicle. And while you won't have electricity or water, you'll still have a great place to camp.
We are talking about RVs, camper vans, and more. People turning to them. Some people turning to them amidst fears of traveling during COVID-19, using them as a way to have more socially distanced travel. Elaine Glusak is with us, Frugal Traveler columnist for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elaine, can you talk about the travel industry a little more generally now, you know, outside the RV world? How hard hit are we right now?
Tremendously. It was really devastating for the industry, from airlines, you know, where, you know, flights dropped 90%, to hotels that shut down, and they were at 20% occupancy nationally. And that was just of the hotels that were open. Many were closed. So, you know, this is a little bit of a bright spot. The RV trend. And also the idea that people want to be outdoors, that's kind of nice. You know, people are recognizing that, hey, they've been shut in for so long, and they're rediscovering nature. Like, it's, you're naturally socially distanced when you're usually, you know, if you're not on a hiking trail that's too crowded. So that's been sort of the alternative that people have turned to is going out, going camping, getting an RV, maybe even taking a road trip without an RV, you know, or car camping. But people still want to travel. We are definitely still seeing that.
Yeah, let's look long-term here, Elaine, and it's too early to predict this, obviously, but what are you watching for to see if people who are turning to RVs or camper vans now, you know, if it turns into their habit, their preferred mode of travel in the future?
Yeah, I think that will be interesting. You know, you mentioned that Airstream sales were up, you know, 11% in May, and that was in a month when so much was closed down. I'm sort of curious what happens when it's all over, or, you know, when we have a vaccine. Are people still going to do this? I don't know. But right now, because, you know, we're really limited on where we can go. You know, you can't even go to Hawaii unless you're quarantining for 14 days, and you certainly can't go to Canada yet. So many things are sort of closed off that people are looking creatively and looking around where they live and sort of discovering the new near is the new normal in travel.
Now, you mentioned you did a little camper van work. Do you have camper van or RV travel on the books for your near future, Elaine?
I would love to. I'm hearing actually that things are really selling out. I was talking to a friend the other day who tried to get a camper van, and she said they're all sold out. You know, everyone wants to go on the weekend. So I would say if anyone's thinking about it, like, think about it soon, because people are discovering this alternative. I don't know that I'm going to get a chance to do it, but I'm definitely doing some road trips this summer.
Elaine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Elaine Glusak, freelance travel writer based in Chicago. Her Frugal Traveler column appears in the New York Times. A couple of you posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page about RVs. Adrian says, for many years, the only vacation I could take was in an RV. Kids, grandkids, dogs, cats, horses all went along. By now, we've been in a lot of states with lots of different configurations of family members. And counterpoint, Andy says, every time we see an RV on the highway, I say to my dear husband, promise me that we'll never have to vacation in one of those. And he does. Share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Protests against police brutality are on their third week in Wisconsin, but when they first started, schools across the state were still in session, mostly online. Madeline Fox reports on how some teachers in areas with the largest and longest running protests talk to their students about the historic moment.
Keeping students engaged with virtual learning was a challenge. Even for those who had a device, an internet connection, and the time and space to work on classes, there's a lot more going on around them that can make school seem like a low priority. So when protests over the death of George Floyd started in Milwaukee at the end of May, 7th grade social studies teacher Joe Menting looked at them as a way to meet kids where they are.
Unfortunately, at home, they aren't really participating like they were in the classroom. So anything that they can see on their own, I try to put the lesson behind that, because at this point, the only way we're going to get them to engage is if it's something that they're truly interested in.
They'd been talking about current events throughout the school year, so it made sense to bring up the protests on their virtual conversation about the news at the start of every class. From there, he steered them towards some of the historical context.
Introducing them to Velar Phillips and other James Groppi and their marches in Milwaukee in 1967.
Phillips, who broke race and gender barriers in local and state politics, led 200 days of protests with Father James Groppi through March 1968 to advocate for open housing. Some of the students had a lot to say, like Rondell Ward Jr., one of Menting's 7th graders.
What got me started on this is seeing all of my culture getting hurt, brutally beaten, killed even over our skin tone. And I thought it was really wrong because we didn't choose to have this.
Ward has been doing a lot of his own research, as well as school assignments. The biggest thing he's noticed is how little has changed despite so many years of protests and outcry.
We had another assignment seeing the old side of Milwaukee and all the protests back then and what was happening, but it hasn't changed. It's still very much the same, but the difference is one is in black and white and one is in color.
Menting students get to put together a passion project presentation on something they feel strongly about, Ward did one on police brutality. And he'd like to get out and participate in history himself, too.
I haven't personally been to any protests because it's been very, very crazy, but I would love to be there and love to show my support over the whole movement.
That's what some older students have been doing. 17-year-old Shanice Knox, a new graduate of Greendale High School, participated in a march at the Islamic Society of Milwaukee that was itself planned by two teenage girls. That was her second protest, and she was just getting warmed up.
I'm hosting one in Greendale. That is at Greendale, this coming up Friday, at the Greendale High School, and we're going to march up to Village Hall and back.
Teachers are also talking about the protests and their context with younger students. Elizabeth O'Leary is a special education teacher for second graders at Madison's Frank Alice Elementary. She says when they started talking to students about the protests, it helped to have already gotten the ball rolling about civil rights and racism during February's Black Lives Matter Week of Action and with history lessons throughout the year.
So we had like an ode to Angela Davis. So our whole door was covered. One day we talked about queer affirming Black lives. And the next day we talked about Black families and communities.
But O'Leary is aware there's a pretty big gap in one area. 2% of Wisconsin teachers are Black or Latino, compared to 16% of students. And that gap is even wider in majority non-white districts like Milwaukee. That means white instructors are often talking about racism with students who have far more lived experience with it than they do.
I've been doing more listening because that's what's important. We need to lift our Black voices, and then I need to be standing next to them or behind them, supporting them in any way that I can.
Formal lessons have come to a close, but teachers and students are still watching and in some cases participating in the protests. And they're thinking ahead to what the world might look like in the fall and how to talk about it. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll take a look at today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling upholding the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Juneteenth marks a celebration of the end of slavery in the United States. Keely Boltina and her guests share celebrations going on around Wisconsin. Tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, is here to stay, at least for now. And one many people are calling a surprising decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to uphold the Obama-era plan. DACA has allowed hundreds of thousands of young immigrants who were brought to America as children to avoid deportation and to stay in the U.S. For nearly 3 years, the Trump administration has tried to end it, but Chief Justice John Roberts said the government failed to provide enough justification for doing so. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called the ruling surprising and amazing.
I cried tears of joy a few minutes ago when I heard the decision of the Supreme Court on DACA. These wonderful DACA kids and their families have a huge burden lifted off their shoulders. They don't have to worry about being deported. They can do their jobs. And I do believe this, someday soon, they will be American citizens.
In a tweet, President Trump wrote, quote, "These horrible and politically charged decisions coming out of the Supreme Court are shotgun blasts into the face of people that are proud to call themselves Republicans or conservatives. We need more justices or we will lose our Second Amendment and everything else." Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at Penn State University. Shobha, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Were you, first of all, surprised by this ruling?
I was somewhat surprised, but just more heartened, and like the senator, was shedding tears of joy while wading through the opinion.
Now, what exactly does this ruling mean for about 650,000 people who had been covered and now still will be covered under DACA?
Well, the decision was held on a narrow issue of administrative law, but what it means for those with DACA is profound and significant. It means that those who have been living in the United States with DACA, working, often supporting their families or going to school, will continue to be protected under deferred action, which is a kind of discretionary protection in immigration. Today's outcome, I think, also opens the door for thousands of new Dreamers to request deferred action for the first time since the policy ended and to realize their potential. So I think the promise and the future is bright. This is an uncertain future, but today's victory is crystal clear.
Now remind us, Shoba, who specifically do DACA protections apply to?
Sure. So DACA is a policy that was announced under the Obama administration and implemented by an agency called the Department of Homeland Security. And it applies to people who came to the United States before the age of 16, who've lived in the United States for over a decade, are in school or graduated, and don't have a criminal history as defined by the agency. It's not a legal status. It's a temporary reprieve. But nevertheless, DACA has changed lives, and it has dignified a whole class of people who call America home.
And Senator Schumer mentioned a hope he had that people covered by DACA could become citizens someday. There's no actual mechanism within the DACA order that provides for that, though, is there?
Correct. DACA does not provide an independent pathway to citizenship. It is not a legal status. It is what I sometimes call immigration purgatory. In order for there to be a pathway to citizenship, that's where Congress needs to act. And this decision only amplifies the role and responsibility that Congress has to do good on Senator Schumer's hope by enacting legislation that provides a permanent solution, not only to people who have DACA, but also to their families and other long-term residents who call America home.
Shoba Sivaprasad-Wadia is with us from the Penn State University Law School looking at the Supreme Court DACA decision earlier today. You can join in with your reaction, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Shoba, DACA in polling is fairly popular. President Trump at some points has spoken favorably of it. He has expressed hopes that it could be extended. He wants Congress to do that. Many in Congress, sometimes on both sides, have said they support it. What's been the obstacle?
Yeah, so President Trump has been volatile, to say the least, in his opinions about DACA. He's flip-flopped both before he became president and after, calling Dreamers good people, but then also making them vulnerable to deportation and calling what Justice Sotomayor said in her dissent or concurrence, rather, equating undocumented immigrants with animals. The obstacle is in part the administration because it created partially the crisis that we're in. There was no reason that the administration had to end DACA in the first place. So in my opinion, he always had the ability to both support and sustain DACA as initiated in 2012, as well as fully support a permanent solution in Congress. The obstacles in Congress are somewhat partisan. They're not policy centered because we've had legislation every year since at least 2001.
Right. These are problems that go back before President Trump or even President Obama. And the argument sometimes, Shoba, is do we do immigration stuff in Congress one thing at a time, DACA and then border security and then whatever, or do we try to do it all at once? And I guess the answer is neither.
Well, and maybe there's nuance there, right? These are old debates, as you mentioned. And there was a time where and when we had bipartisan support for holistic immigration legislation. So when we return to that era remains to be seen. What I don't want to see happen politically is for DACA to be used as a horse trade for amplified immigration enforcement. We already have a lot of immigration enforcement at our border, in our detention centers, and against people who are just trying to live their lives and support their families. So I hope that any effort in Congress to enact DREAM Act-like legislation doesn't come with the cost of more immigration enforcement.
Now, there's so much going on in the United States right now with protests over police brutality, with the pandemic going on. Do you see DACA emerging as a substantial issue in the presidential race this year?
I hope it is an issue and a face that both political parties can rally around. And there's not a distinction in every case between what's happening in our world with the pandemic, for example, and DACA. We all saw the supplemental filing in the U.S. Supreme Court and saw the documentation of the nearly 30,000 people with DACA who are healthcare workers, who are working on our front lines, who are saving patients' lives, and others who are suffering from COVID-19. So I don't see the climate as unrelated. Certainly, it complicates having an immigration conversation in a silo, but I think there are also ways to connect the dots.
We're talking about the future of people protected by DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, after today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling saying it can stay in effect. Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia is our guest, faculty scholar and clinical law professor at Penn State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the ruling? Do you think the Supreme Court got it right or wrong? Do you want to see the Trump administration bring this back, as they may be able to do? Are you affected by this decision personally, either you or someone in your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's four liberal justices in blocking the Trump administration's bid to end DACA. Our guest is Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia, law professor at Penn State, and you can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. What do you make of today's decision? Are you glad that DACA is here to stay for now? Were you hoping the court would strike it down? What, if anything, do you want to see come from Congress when it comes to DACA, maybe as part of a bigger immigration agreement? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Earlier today, I talked to a Wisconsin immigrant who was protected under the DACA program. Liliana Luera Rivera was born in Monterrey, Mexico, and raised in Madison. She's been a DACA recipient since 2012 and works with Children's Wisconsin as a bilingual education and employment specialist. Liliana, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
You're a DACA recipient yourself. Can you share your story, please?
Yes, I've been a DACA recipient since 2012 when President Obama made the announcement. I remember it was summer. I was in the living room with my dad, and we were watching his speech. And I remember, like, when he made that, I literally started crying, you know, happy, excited. You know, I was like, finally, I can do the things that my peers have been able to do. You know, get a driver's license, continue higher education. And not only that, like, I have been able to travel within the U.S. now without the fear of deportation. You know, traveling has changed my life, you know, and I'm, like, very privileged and, like, excited to have, like, the DACA program in my life.
How old were you when you found out?
Yeah, I was 17. I was just about to start my senior year in high school, La Follette.
And can you tell us about when you came into the country? How old were you then?
Yes, I was 2 years old. I came with my mom. You had our visitor visa, you know, but we just overstayed because there was more opportunities here in the U.S. So I've been living here 24 years undocumented.
And what has the uncertainty been like? And there's still some uncertainty. This court decision doesn't resolve everything. What does this uncertainty mean for your daily life?
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, like there has been so much uncertainty in my life the past couple of years now since Trump was elected into office. You know, this is great news. You know, it's a huge victory for DACA recipients. But like, you know, the fight is not over. You know, people need to realize that what we need is a comprehensive immigration reform next. You know, there's still 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, and we should all have the opportunity to live here, you know, be out, not be in the shadows, you know. But I think that's what's the next step, and especially for me, you know, like I'm about to start graduate school here at UW-Madison. I'll be going into my master's in social work. So there was another uncertainty, like, will I be able to finish my career? You know, you have to do an internship. And without the working permit, I wouldn't have been able to do my internship.
As we wrap up, Liliana, I understand you work at Children's Wisconsin now as a bilingual education and employment specialist. If you complete that social work master's, what are you hoping to do as a career?
Yes, I'm still in the works what I want to do, but I do want to work with the immigrant community. You know, as a bilingual education employment specialist, I've been working with mixed statuses, you know, within the families. I've seen there's, you know, it's not great having to work with undocumented immigrants and they can't better themselves because they don't have the opportunity to have the high paying job that they deserve. You know, so I want to continue working with the immigrant community and hopes to do that with my master's.
Liliana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Liliana Loera Rivera, born in Monterrey, Mexico, raised in Madison. She has been protected under DACA, talking about her reactions and her experiences. The U.S. Supreme Court saying DACA could stay in effect, at least for now. Back to our guest, Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia from Penn State Law School. How common is Liliana's story?
Well, first, it was so inspiring to hear her words. And in the conversations I've had with DACA recipients over the years, it's also pretty common. And I want to talk a little bit about this uncertainty that she mentioned, because one conversation I've had with many DACA recipients is the so-called psychological warfare that the termination of DACA had on so many. And I think that this decision does not resolve it, but it certainly reduces it. So I see that as an invisible facet, if you will, of the win. But the contributions that Liliana is making mirrors what so many DACA recipients do every day, whether it's on college campuses. I'm on a big college campus where I've been able to witness firsthand the benefits of having DACA recipients in the classroom, but also in the workforce, in our schools, in our hospitals. The list goes on.
Now, an argument here against DACA protections and other protections for people who did not cross the border under a legal path is that it was not legal, and this kind of recognition, this kind of protection incentivizes potentially people to do the same, to cross the border into the U.S. and stay here in an illegal way, or to overstay visas or whatever the case may be. What do you say to that concern, Shobha?
Yeah, so I find that to be a misguided argument. It was one that the government made both in its briefing and during oral argument, and the reality is that even to qualify for DACA, you have to have lived in the United States for over a decade. So the fact that a policy that requires a decade plus residence plus other requirements would incentivize people to enter without inspection, to me, is a bit misguided. Further, we have to look at the reasons why people are coming to the United States in the first place. And for many of the individuals and families I'm aware of or have met with personally who came to the U.S., many are fleeing. So there are other things that are driving people to the United States that an outcome in DACA is not going to change.
It's Brianna Caller. Now Olvid is with us in Green Bay. Olvid, hi.
Hi, Rob. Huge fan of your show. I know you guys were trying to find DACA recipients, and I kind of just wanted to share my story real quick.
Yeah, what is your story, Olvid?
I actually got DACA when I was 18, right before I turned 19. Basically, it enabled me to get a driver's license. Basically, I feel more normal, if I could say that. I was able to go to college, graduate, and I work as an electrician now.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your story. Are other people in your family, though, in a more difficult situation?
They are. My sister and I both are DACA recipients. My parents they're still undocumented. I wouldn't say DACA has pretty much made everything great. I pretty much planned my life in 2-year spans, basically because I renew my DACA every 2 years. So there's always that question if I'm still going to be able to do it or not.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Shoba, that reminds me something I didn't mention at the outset. People who are protected under DACA have to keep reapplying, right? As Olvid said, every 2 years.
Correct. So the term is renewal, as was mentioned. And once you receive DACA, that lasts for a 2-year period. So there is a renewal process. And I, too, have heard many times from DACA recipients about how they conduct their lives in 2-year increments. So this decision today allows that to continue, but to have real certainty, ultimately, we're going to need a solution by Congress.
Olvid, thanks a lot for that call. And that's the big story now, Shoba. Do you feel like Congress is going to try to tackle this and resolve DACA one way or another anytime soon?
So I'm hesitant to say yes with an exclamation point, given where the chambers are as we speak. On the other hand, maybe the collision of this moment we're in with the global pandemic, major attention to an issue of racism that for so long has gone unnoticed, a unusual Supreme Court decision, and a presidential election. Maybe that's the collision that will renew a discussion of the DREAM Act in Congress. But for now, I'm going to pay attention to the details and to see how the courts decide to process today's decision at the lower level and then what the agency decides to do. Will it behave in a way by reinstating DACA 2012, which is what I hope, or will it take a different pathway, maybe issue a new memo? These are some of the questions we still don't have answers to.
Shoba, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia is a professor at Penn State Law School. We talked to her today about today's 5-4 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Wisconsin man shares his routine encounters with racism from elementary school to adulthood. Colleges and universities have been backing away from standardized tests like the ACT and SAT. We'll find out why the coronavirus outbreak may speed up that trend. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll take a look at Cajun-style cooking. Our guest says there's a lot more going on than we might have seen on TV when it comes to Cajun food and Cajun culture, for that matter. Find out more and get some great recipes for the weekend. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Keeley Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. tomorrow at 8. It's the weekly call-in for kids and parents, this time with the investigators from the Odd Squad on PBS Kids. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then restaurants took a big financial hit when they were closed during the coronavirus outbreak, and reopening is expensive in its own right. We'll find out how restaurant owners are dealing with the costs. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.